I'm Wade Keller, editor and publisher of the Pro Wrestling Torch newsletter and former host here at PW Torch Livecast. If you're looking for my shows, they have moved as of July 2017. They're now called the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Podcast, available through Podcast One. Enter Wade Keller on your podcast app or iTunes and subscribe to the new Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Podcast, where I cover Raw and my first show of the week, SmackDown, with my second show of the week, and then the Flagship Edition with a co-host, and we cover a broad array of pro wrestling current events, and then I end the week with a weekly interview. That's the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Podcast, now at Podcast One. Subscribe today. Just search Wade Keller.
Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to MMA Talk for Pro Wrestling Fans. Today is Monday, October 9th. I am your host, Mike Rocky, and I will soon be joined by my two co-hosts for today's show, Robert Vallejos and Sean Ennis. Guys, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining me today.
Great to be here.
All right. And also, for the listeners out there, we'd love for you to be part of today's show as well. So if you have a question or a comment on today's show regarding anything we're talking about, or if you have just some other questions that you want to bring to our attention, we'd love to hear from you. The number to call is 515-605-9345. Again, it's 515-605-9345. If you do want to join the show live, please remember to press 1, and that will tell us that you want to be on the show. Or if you prefer to email the show, you can do that as well. The email address is mmalivecast@gmail.com. Again, the email address is mmalivecast@gmail.com. All right, guys, let's start today's show with reviewing Saturday night's UFC event. It was a historic show, as well as an entertaining show, I thought. Before we get into the fights themselves, Sean, we'll start with you. To give it a grade, what would you kind of grade the show?
I'd probably give it a solid B, if I'm grading on a curve, probably.
And Robert, what were your thoughts?
Given all the last minute scratches and whatnot.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I would give it a B too. I think it exceeded my expectations for the card, but it wasn't like this blowaway event. But I was pretty happy that I spent the money, even though I had my trepidation going in.
Yeah, especially after the news of Derek Lewis being scratched last minute. There was a lot of talk about, you know, was the show worth the money? Which, after the show ended, I thought it was worth the money. I gave it a solid B2, maybe a B+. But anyway, let's get into the main card here and start with the main event, where we had Tony Ferguson beating Kevin Lee by submission by way of a triangle choke, 4 minutes and 2 seconds into round 3. Now, I think what I'm going to hear from both of you guys is you were surprised, or maybe not surprised, by the way Kevin Lee came out and started the fight, how well he looked, how good he was doing. But from my perspective, I thought this was Tony Ferguson's game plan from the get-go. I think his plan was to let Derek or Kevin Lee come out, throw punches, exhaust himself as much as he can, trying to get takedowns, working from top, getting up, getting back down, things like that. And I think this played out exactly the way Ferguson wanted it to. And the fight ended, I think, just the way he envisioned it. So with that said, Robert, I'll start with you. What were your thoughts of the fight? And where do you see Ferguson going from here?
Yeah, I do. I'm in agreement with you that it was probably a strategy by Ferguson to let him sort of punch himself out. With that said, some of the stuff he was doing was kind of working at the beginning, so it looked like the risk reward might not have paid off for Ferguson. But once they got past that first round, Tony was completely in control of everything, and you could tell that Kevin Lee had given it his best shot, and it wasn't quite good enough. As far as where Ferguson goes from here, I know this fight was sold on being the golden ticket to face Conor McGregor, but there's just no guarantees of what McGregor – where nothing as far as the status quo goes applies to McGregor. So in theory, he should get McGregor. If he doesn't get McGregor, though, it's not like this is such a thin division that he'll have no contenders or nobody else, to go with. I would love the Khabib fight. I don't even know if Ferguson wants to go down that road again. If that's not an option, look, the winner of this tough would be a great option to go up against Ferguson. I think Justin Gaethje, obviously he's going to be exciting any fight he has, but come on, Gaethje versus Ferguson would just be a phenomenal fight. That would be a 5-round fight. I'll take that all day long.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, I just started salivating at the thought of Tony Ferguson and Justin Gaethje. I think it definitely became apparent as the fight went on that this was his strategy. I didn't recognize it at first that that's what he was doing, but it became apparent as the fight wore on that he was kind of biding his time and waiting for Lee to tire himself out. He didn't go quite the full Rocky III strategy where you almost lose the fight and then wait for the guy to get tired and win, but it was on that same trajectory, although not nearly as drastic. But in hindsight, obviously, turned out to be the right strategy, and it was pretty apparent at the end of the second round that the fight was not going to go on that much longer.
Yeah, even from the beginning, or leading up to the point up to the fight, I didn't see this fight going the full five rounds. Robert, going back to some of your points here. So yeah, there's two ways. Well, I guess. Possibly more for kind of from McGregor's perspective here. You've got the Diaz trilogy sitting out there and Tony Ferguson. I think those are probably the two, I guess, obvious ways to go. Now, could he take another boxing match against Malignaggi? I guess that's always possible. But I think chances are pretty good that it's either going to be Ferguson or Diaz. If you were a betting man, Robert, which fight do you think we see next?
Just because I think McGregor has the autonomy to call his shot, I think Diaz is the next fight because that's the more marketable, more profitable fight. Even though in reality, the Ferguson fight might end up being a better fight, but I think we're more likely to get the Diaz-McGregor fight.
Yeah, do you take any stock in Dana White saying that they haven't even discussed a Nate Diaz, Conor McGregor trilogy?
No, and one, it's Dana, so you can't take stock in anything he says in public statements. But beyond that, he's kind of met, it seems like he's danced around it for a while, so I'm pretty sure they've explored it, and he's been so frustrated with Nate, not taking any fights. So obviously he's aware of what Nate is holding out for.
Yeah, and I was kind of headed that same down that same path where I think they're finding out that I think Nate Diaz maybe just be pricing him out of any fight at this point. I think that's very possible. Sean, what if where does Khabib kind of where does he fit into this whole puzzle, if anywhere?
To me, he's kind of the wild card because with Khabib, you can't count on him to stay healthy to fight someone. How many times has he been scheduled against Ferguson at this point? Like three. And it's always fallen out. And I just don't see how you can count on Nurmagomedov at this point to be in a big fight. I think it's probably that having been said, it's probably the fight to make if for some reason Ferguson doesn't fight McGregor. But I just don't know. I don't know how you can count on that. To me, you almost want to get Nurmagomedov in there for two fights over the course of 6 or 8 months just to make sure that he can do it, before booking that fight. But at the same time, if you can get him in there for between 6 and 8 months, between 6 and 8 months, then you're almost wasting fights that he's actually participating in against lower competition. So
yeah,
it's quite a conundrum as far as I'm concerned with Khabib.
Yeah, I would be happy, like both of you said, with the tough winner, for sure. I think that would be a really good fight. Or Conor McGregor. I think those are the only really two viable options we have right now. So, but we'll see what happens. Let's move on to the co-main event here, where we had Demetrius Johnson beating Ray Borg by submission by way of an armbar, 3 minutes and 15 seconds into the fifth round. And I don't know what else you can, what other superlatives you can, or adjectives you can throw out there about DJ at this point. Granted, I think Borg was a little bit, this was a little early for Borg. But nonetheless, Borg's a tough guy. He's a good fighter. I think he's going to definitely be, if not a champion down the road, he's always going to be hovering around the top of the division. But DJ just made... I mean, it just looked like it was like a man against a boy out there. I just couldn't believe just the way he dominated that. He did anything and everything he wanted to, and he did it at will. And then not even mentioning the way the fight finished, which I still can't get over, and I'm still going over it on my DVR. Sean, I'll start with you on this one. What were your thoughts of the fight? And really, what's left for Johnson at this point?
At flyweight, there's nothing left for him, because it's like you said, you pretty much summed it up. There's nothing left to say about Demetrius Johnson at flyweight. You know, who else can he beat to make us think, wow, this guy really has cleaned out the division? There's the possibility of the winner between Sergio Pettis and Henry Cejudo, but really, what does that even prove? You know, anyone at flyweight is overmatched by Demetrius Johnson at this point. There's nothing left for him to do here that is going to add to his legacy. I think he wanted, at least I hope, his reasoning was that I want to stay at this weight class and break Anderson Silva's record for consecutive defenses, and then I will start branching out, because I think that's really where his legacy is going to be secured. You know, I think we'll talk about the whole GOAT situation later on in the show, but to me, I think knowing the way that he's been talking about, you know, how important this record is to him, to me, I have to wonder if now that he's broken it, that is secure for him, that I wonder if he's going to be now branching out and saying, send me new challenges. At least I hope that's what he's going to be doing.
And what's so amazing about him, too, is he takes the strength of whoever he's fighting and just completely dominates them in their, you know, in whatever their strength is. And it's exactly what he did to Borg here. Robert, what were your thoughts of
The thing was, and sorry, I just one more thing along those, no, you're good, along those lines. If I heard someone say that if it was a video game, Demetrius Johnson is a 99 in all aspects. And he is. He's the best in the division at everything. It doesn't matter what someone's strength is, he's better at it. So that's kind of the remarkable thing about him.
Yep.
Yeah, no, just to follow up on Sean's point, I think that's part of really what makes Mighty Mouse so great, is he is a true mixed martial artist in that he's not just good at one thing and then is adequate in another area. He's very good in all facets of the game. Where does he go from here? That's hard to say. I wouldn't hate another Cejudo fight if he were to beat Pettis, just because of how good he looked in that last fight. But that doesn't really do anything for anyone. I do think this record specifically was very important to Mighty Mouse. For as good of a fighter as he is, you know, he's never going to be a guy that's going to get a pay-per-view record or really be talked about in that way. So he needed some way to really cement himself in the history book. And I think that's what this quest really was all about. I kind of hope I don't necessarily want to see him go up in weight class. I just would like other people who are surrounding that weight class to come in to, you know, see who can knock him off. And so it's almost like these gimmicky fights is really all that's left from him, which the whole idea of a gimmicky fight doesn't really fit Mighty Mouse's persona in any way.
Yeah, that's true. And to both your points, breaking this record was definitely very important to him. It was so important to him, he dodged TJ Dillashaw to do it. Still kind of hold that against DJ, but it's an argument for another time, or maybe later in the show. All right, let's move along here. Hey, kudos to Walt Harris for taking this fight. If it really even was a fight, I don't even know if he landed anything. But Walt Harris stepped in for Derek Lewis at the extreme last minute here,
and was really outmatched by Verdum here. It was Verdum going over Harris by submission with an armbar a minute 5 into the first round. Really not much to say here. He was just completely outmatched by Verdum. But that being said, you know, you're still going into a fight against another man, and he just made it look easy. Sean, any thoughts on this one?
Not much, really. It was pretty predictable what was going to happen there, especially once it got to the ground and they're still dry. It was just a matter of time.
Yeah, as predictable as it was, it still happened very quick. So I was still stunned by how quickly it went. Robert, what about you?
Yeah, it was a little jarring how quickly it went. It's good to see that squash matches have now made their way into UFC pay-per-views. But with that said, it is kind of crazy the way that he had, like, literally, you know, some guys say, oh, I don't train for a specific opponent because my opponents always pull out. But, I mean, this guy couldn't even consider his opponent, being only hours before getting him, and he still just went right through him.
Yeah, he really did. So I don't even know where that leaves, you know, Verdum going forward. I mean, obviously this didn't do anything for him as far as rankings or anything like that. So it's really hard to say. And, you know, I feel bad for Lewis. It was a fight I was definitely looking forward to. You know, this is a recurring back issue. It sounds like it's pretty bad. I wouldn't be surprised to see him probably retire for good after this. Any thoughts on that from either of you before we move on? All right. The silence will tell me to move along.
It was deafening.
All right. And then I think in the Borrella Faria fight, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think they were both making their UFC debuts. I know Borrella was.
Yeah, they were. They were both.
Okay, I thought so. So, yeah, in this fight, it was Borrella over Faria by submission with a rear naked choke. In round one, I didn't get the time on that one, but it was definitely round one. Another pretty short fight. I thought Borrella just looked incredible for her first fight. I think she was a 2-1 underdog in this one. So Faria was definitely the betting favorite, and it just did not look that way once the fight started. Robert, we'll start with you on this. What were your thoughts of Borrella's performance? And, you know, is she, you know, future contender in the division?
Well, and I thought she did very well in this fight. It's hard to say because we just don't know what that division's gonna look like. I do appreciate the fact that they're booking fights in this division even before the division is really formulated, because like when you have featherweight, there's not really like a women's featherweight division in the UFC. There's a women's featherweight title that gets defended. It's not really the top of a division, which I think it's fine because of the circumstances. You know, that's okay. But, you know, they're not even pretending like it's a division. Here you could see that they're actually laying some of the groundwork to put some of the plumbing, so to speak, in to have a division. So, you know, I'm excited for this whole division. We've been talking about that for a while. And Borrella screams at the end of the fight or something else. I don't know if she was really happy or really mad, but the way she was just screaming at the top of her lungs was a sight to be seen.
Yeah, it was ear piercing. I couldn't imagine being, you know, cage side for that. Sean, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, the screams kind of freaked me out a little bit, but she looked fantastic. I mean, the flyweight division is going to be interesting to watch. I think there you can tell that the UFC actually has plans, or actually, you know, it seems like it would be obvious that the UFC kind of makes plans to introduce divisions, but you can actually tell that they have thought about how they want to introduce this division, whereas, you know, they probably thought about it with featherweight too and said, well, we have one fighter that's marketable and we don't even know who else fights at 145, so let's just do that. And so here, you know, they're kind of building a division, like Robert said, before they crown a champion, which is smart, because if you get someone in there like Borrella and you get a couple other you know, fighters in there that do well and make a splash and are memorable, then you have some you know, some at least somewhat marketable matches, you know, or we'll use that term as a relative. But you have some known quantities at that point that you can actually push as, you know, this is the top of the division rather than just throwing some people in there from Invicta that most people haven't seen.
Yeah, plus you're going to have the, you know, some of the girls from the Ultimate Fighter. You're going to have some women move up, and you'll probably have some women move down from bantamweight as well. So I think it's going to be a fun division. All right, guys, in the main card opener, it was Benil Dariush and Evan Dunham fighting to a majority draw. It was 29-28, 28-29, and then 28-28. I had this fight scored 28-28, so I had it a draw as well. It was a clear 10-8 in the first, and then Dunham took the second and third 10-9. Robert, did you have it any other way? What were your thoughts?
I thought Dariush was going to win, to be honest with you, when the fight was over, but I was not shocked. The draw is probably a more appropriate decision for this fight. I mean, we see it all the time, and they made the Chael Sonnen quote, you know, if you fight to knock someone out and don't do it, you're going to lose. And I think that was very applicable here and in the main event, really. It was kind of a similar tale in both of them. Dariush looked great at the beginning, but once he gassed out, it really was Dunham's fight. It was weird. It was kind of a slow-moving fight, but it was weirdly entertaining, I think, because it was so competitive and there were so many ups and downs in it.
Yeah, this fight was definitely more entertaining than I even expected it to be. Sean, what were your thoughts?
Yeah, this is all that I was hoping for from this fight. I'm a big Evan Dunham guy, and, you know, he obviously proved to be really durable here again, as he usually does. You know, that's kind of the backhanded compliment in MMA, is the guy is really hard to put away, because what it means is he takes a lot of punishment. So, yeah. But you know, it's not really surprising to see that again from Evan Dunham. But also, you know, a lot of fun to watch when a guy can take the kind of beating that he did in round one and then win the next two rounds. So, I did have it scored as a draw as well. So I was pleased with the result. It's funny that we had, you know, spoiler a little bit, but we had two draws on the card and nobody seemed really outraged about it.
Yeah, it's true. Any thoughts on the prelims before we take our first break here? The only thing I want to mention is how bad Tom Dukinwa looked. I couldn't believe how bad he looked in that fight. I was shocked by that performance.
Yeah, and he looks lost on the feet, which is very strange, because we've seen him look really vicious on the feet before, and he just looked like he had no idea what was going on. And, you know, as far as the other prelims, the ones of the standouts, obviously, were the Lando Venata and Bobby Green fight, and then John Moraga going out there and taking care of Magomed, I don't even know how to say his last name, Bibulatov.
That was surprising.
Just go out there and taking care of business. Moraga always has that power, and if you choose to stay with him, you're always taking that risk. So that was... that was fun to see.
I was happy for him, and you could tell he was really overwhelmed with emotion after winning that, because he was probably close to getting cut. It he looked bad in that fight.
Yeah. So,
all right, guys, let's take our first break, and then when we come back, we do have a caller on. No, he dropped off. Sorry about that. We will take our first break, and when we come back, we will hit the MMA news stories of the week.
We know you're a pro wrestling fan, but you might like MMA too. And if so, check out our sister site, MMATorch.com, with live fight event coverage, including UFC pay-per-views, previews of all UFC and Bellator events, the daily news digest, exclusive columns, flashbacks, and much more. Check it out. If you're a fan of MMA, you'll be a fan of MMATorch.com.
All right, guys, let's tackle some of the latest MMA news stories. First, we had, let's start with Cody Garbrandt. Justin Buchholz, the head coach of Team Alpha Male, made some news by stating current bantamweight champion Cody Garbrandt would consider dropping down to 125 to challenge Demetrius Johnson. I'm a little conflicted here. While I'd like to see the fight, and I might be totally wrong here, but it almost... to me, is a slap in the face to Dillashaw. Because if they're looking past Dillashaw in this fight, I think they're making a big mistake, because I'm not so sure Garbrandt even wins the fight. Sean, I would start with you on if Garbrandt does beat Dillashaw, is that a fight you'd want to see, or would you rather see DJ move up to challenge both Garbrandt and Dillashaw?
I think I'm on the side of Robert. I think it was Robert that said it, that I'd like to see people come down to fight Johnson if they're able to, rather than seeing Johnson go up. I'm totally down for that fight. I mean, I'd love to see whoever wins that fight drop down and fight DJ, honestly. I think that's it's in everyone's best interest. You know, as far as a sellable fight, Bantamweight is a great division right now. They've got a lot going on. But a super fight with Demetrius Johnson, to me, is something, if you can do it, you got to do it. So I'd be great with that.
Yeah, Robert, what are your thoughts?
I'm pretty much in agreement with Sean there. I don't think they're necessarily looking past TJ. I think, to be honest, I think the winner of TJ and Cody, if Dominic Cruz, depending on how his future fight goes, isn't going to be a thing. That person's going to fight Mighty Mouse anyway. So I just think it's more of a formality. And I'm really interested in that. And I think, look, I don't think you can headline a pay-per-view necessarily with that card, but it's one of those on one of these big sort of ensemble cards with two or three title fights. I think that would be a heck of a selling point as a real strengthener. They used to do that with Mighty Mouse. He was always on John Jones's cards before they started putting him out on his own and then relegating him down to TV. So I think that would be a great fight. And there's a lot of stories that the UFC could promote and tell with that fight.
Yeah. And you mentioned Dominic Cruz. He's kind of like the wild card here. So let's say he gets past who's he fighting? Jimmy Rivera in his next fight. So let's say he gets past him. I mean, obviously he's going to want another shot at the title, right? So I don't know how, you know, I mean, are you going to hold up the division, whoever wins that Garbrandt fight, for a DJ fight? I don't know if that makes much sense. So I think it probably makes more sense for Cruz to get another crack at either Garbrandt or Dillashaw, and then, you know, have DJ probably fight the winner of the Cejudo fight, which I would favor Cejudo in that fight. And again, like I think it was Robert that mentioned, that would be a fight I wouldn't mind seeing. But I don't know. I'm a little torn on that. I think I would rather not have a division.
Go ahead. I say hold up the division. Hold it up. Do it.
You're a fan of the new. You're a fan of the new UFC.
Right. You know, in some ways, at some times, yeah, I did. When the best interest of the sport collides with the best interest of the money, I say do it. And really, you know, super fights are few and far between. Really, the opportunity for super fights are few and far between. And I'm not saying that Cody Garbrandt has cleared out the division by any sense of a stretch of the imagination, but he's a guy who could give DJ a fight and who could be presented as a guy who could give DJ a fight. And I think if you've got that, then take it, you know, take it when you can, because it's not always going to be there.
Yeah, for sure.
Garbrandt or Dillashaw, I should say, either one of those guys.
Yeah, you make a strong argument. Robert, anything to add before we move on?
Yeah, I think it's just a case-by-case basis on this new booking philosophy. In this case, it makes sense. It's not like it's not like he's like a Michael Bisping who it seemed like was never going to defend the title and just wanted super fights immediately. He's taking on the top contender. You know, he beat the longtime champ and he's taking on the clear top challenger. So he hasn't cleaned out the division, but the scores in the division would have been settled by that point.
Yeah.
Also, I would add in there that this is an actual super fight, whereas Bisping has been going after money fights. none of Bisping's fights have actually been super fights, because half of in order to have a super fight, I don't think Michael Bisping could be in a super fight, because I don't think anyone actually sees him as the top of the middleweight division.
I agree with that. All right, guys, let's move on here. We had Anthony Johnson's manager was on the MMA Hour and spoke about a potential return for Rumble. And if there is a return for Johnson, his manager alluded to that it would be at heavyweight. Excuse me. So, I don't know. Again, you know, when he retired after losing to Cormier, I really got the sense he was at peace with the decision, especially considering how he's getting involved in the marijuana business. And if I remember right, I thought he was always pretty outspoken about the potential risks of concussions and CTE. So I always thought that kind of weighed heavily on his mind. So I really wasn't, while I was shocked by the retirement, I wasn't surprised by it after I thought about it a little bit more. So taking all that into consideration, Robert, what are your thoughts of the news? And does heavyweight make sense for Rumble?
It's funny. I can't think of a better fighter that would be coming out of retirement that I have more apathy toward than Rumble Johnson coming out of retirement and going to the heavyweight division. Yes, it's interesting because he's a powerful guy. He's, you know, think of the weight classes this guy has fought at, and he might finally be in his natural weight class at heavyweight. I don't know if he's so special at heavyweight the way he is at light heavyweight with his power, because everybody in the heavyweight division who can strike really hard. And I understand it, though, in the sense that, you know, Daniel Cormier is to Rumble Johnson as to what John Jones is to Daniel Cormier, in that he can beat everybody else, but he can't get past this one guy. So if you just go to heavyweight division and you're not going to deal with Cormier, maybe you can make a legacy. It's hard to get a read on Rumble because, you know, we know outside of the octagon at times he's a bit of a madman and a controversial figure, but he's also so aloof and so, you know, I can't get a read on what this guy really is.
Yeah, I see your point there. I would actually prefer, if he were to come back, I would prefer him to come back in at a heavyweight, just because the division's so thin, and I think he can make a. I think he'll do well. I mean, definitely against the bottom half of the division. I don't see much trouble for him. Not saying he's going to be a title contender, but if he were to come back, I would prefer seeing him in heavyweight. Sean, what are your thoughts?
Yes, heavyweight. Yes, please. Now, do it now. Do it yesterday. I want to see it. I want to see, because here's the thing, man. Like, you know, Robert mentioned Anthony Johnson has power. Anthony Johnson has, like, transcendent power. Anthony Johnson has like mythical power. He has some ridiculous power, you know, and I want to see if that translates to heavyweight. If he can put people out at heavyweight like he can put them out in other weight classes, then that's going to be a real problem for those guys, because Anthony Johnson is not only powerful, but he's fast. And, you know, I obviously he's not going to beat Daniel Cormier probably in any weight class, but if you throw him in there with Stipe or, you know, any of those guys, Overeem, I would love any fight, including Anthony Johnson at heavyweight. I would love it. I want to see it right now. And if you have a guy who's concerned about concussions, where he should go is the place where people hit the hardest.
And then with Rumble's luck, Cormier will move up too.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. So once upon a time, Johnny Hendricks seemed pretty much unbeatable. He sent GSP into retirement after the beating he put on him at UFC 167. Then he came right back and beat Robbie Lawler for the vacant welterweight title. Well, since that win, Hendricks is now 2-5 and has missed weight three times in two different weight classes. So now we get word that he's moving his training for UFC 217 over to Jackson Wink in hopes of reviving a once promising career. Sean, what are your thoughts of the decision, and will it make a difference?
Jeez, I think it's a good decision. Any time where you can switch up where you're training and look for a better camp, I think is a strong decision to make. Is it going to make any difference? I don't know, man. I'm struggling to think of, and I may just be not thinking of the right guys, but I'm trying to think of someone who is switch camps to Jackson Wink recently and really seen a drastic improvement. And I'm struggling to come up with them, but then again, I have a bad memory for who's changed camps. So, you know, I think the improvement is probably going to be there, but his thing also has to do with discipline and weight. So is that going to be part of the package? You know, is he going to use, does Jackson Wink have different nutritionists? Is he going back with Dolce? You know, I don't know. I think that's going to be the real factor in whether we see a better Johnny Hendricks, is whether he can manage his weight or if he decides to just fight at middleweight. That's kind of the wild card for me is what's going to happen with that.
Yeah, Robert, do you think this makes any difference in his game?
I don't know that it will, just because, and I think the elephant in the room always with Johnny Hendricks is that he's won one fight in the USADA era, and I'm not accusing him because I don't have any evidence, but there was definitely a change in his fighting ability and his ability to make weight once that came to be. Now, with him going to Jackson, the example people usually point to is Andrei Arlovsky, who had a bit of a career renaissance when he went over there. And people like to point to how when Travis Brown disassociated himself from Jackson, how his career took a dive. I just don't know. I think it's more internal, though. I don't know who you can be around. It seems like it's more in Hendrick's head than anything somebody can do in a training setting, unless that the change of environment just totally rejuvenates the guy. It's just hard to say at this point what he can still be.
Well, talk about rejuvenating his career. First, you make the change in weight class, right? Then, if that doesn't go well, okay, now let's change camps. I think this is he's running out of ideas and, for the most part, excuses on why he can't make weight, why he's not winning fights. So this is really UFC 217 is really a make it break it for him, I think. So let's take one more quickly here before we take our second break. We talked last week a little bit about the return of Carlos Condit, but at the time he didn't have a fight. Now he does. He's taking on Neil Magny at UFC 219 on December 30th. The UFC has yet to announce a main event for the card. But Robert, what were your thoughts when you first heard about the fight?
To be honest, I was just a little underwhelmed. And not that Magny's a bad fighter or anything. It just, like, when we were hyping this up, we sort of had these fantasy matchups in our head that we thought would be awesome, or we had like the RDA matchup, what would seem really consequential. And, Magny was just kind of like, okay, that's it. With that said, I mean, he's probably on the level that maybe a guy in a comeback fight should be fighting at. So if he can get past Magny, I don't know that he can. If he can do it, he could feel pretty good about himself, but without having to face that supreme challenge. So I don't necessarily like the fight, but it's probably the right fight for him to take at this point.
Yeah, so my first reaction was like yours. I was just like kind of deflated, like, huh, okay. Well, at least he's coming back, so that'll be fun. But yeah, again, just, yeah, I wasn't overwhelmed by it. Sean, what did you think?
Yeah, I think this is quite simply a barometer fight. They want to see where Condit is. And this is going to show us. This is going to be – Neil Magny is a good measure of where you fit in the division. So if Carlos Condit can come out there and take care of business against Neil Magny, yeah, give me that RDA fight. Give me that Robbie Lawler rematch. Give me something more intriguing. But what we didn't want to see is if Condit has lost a step or something like that, I don't want to see him go out there and get obliterated by RDA or Lawler or one of those guys. I want him to go out there and be competitive. So – If he comes out there and takes care of Magny, then let's move on. And if not, then, well, that tells us something too.
Yep. All right, let's take our second break there. And then when we come back, we will play another round of Fact or Fiction.
Support what we do here at the PW Torch Livecast when you shop Amazon. Simply go to pwtorch.com/Amazon. We've simplified the page. There's a big Amazon logo. You click on it. It takes you right to Amazon's homepage. But because of that small detour, we get credit for your visit, and we get a commission on anything you buy on that shopping trip. That's pwtorch.com/Amazon. Thank you very much for your support.
All right. It's time for another round of Fact or Fiction, where I make a statement to both Robert and Sean, and they decide if that statement is indeed fact or fiction. So we'll start the first one here with Sean. Demetrius Johnson is the greatest MMA fighter of all time. Fact or fiction?
Fiction. And I say fiction not based on Demetrius Johnson not being impressive. I say that based on the level of fighters that he's been dominating. And that's not his fault, but I can't look at the run that Demetrius Johnson has had and equate it to the run of, say, GSP. I mean, when you look at who Demetrius Johnson fight, let's just look at the last, six fights, right? You got Ray Borg, Wilson Hayes, Tim Elliott, Henry Cejudo, John Dodson. And then you bring up GSP. GSP's last five fights, Johnny Hendricks, Nick Diaz, Carlos Condit, Jake Shields, Jeff Koscheck. Even before that, Thiago Alves, BJ Penn, John Fitch, Matt Hughes, Koscheck again. GSP was fighting everybody. He was fighting murderers. I mean, he fought he fought guys in the welterweight division when the welter, and you know, those names may be underwhelming in 2017, but when GSP was fighting, you know, he was fighting guys that were universally seen as the top of the heap. I mean, that was a murderer's row. I'm more impressed with, from a name value, from a significance of the fight value. I've been more impressed with Tony Ferguson's recent run than the guys that Demetrius Johnson has been fighting. And you know, that's not to diminish Johnson's accomplishments. I'm just saying that he's not the pound for pound greatest of all time because of the level of fighter that he's been fighting. You know, and we mentioned earlier he could have fought TJ Dillashaw in this last fight and chose not to. So, you know, that says something too. You know, he wanted to get this record, you know, and that's fine, but he had a chance to fight a tougher fighter, a tougher level of competition, and didn't do it. So, you know, I don't think we can crown him as the GOAT at this point, despite the gulf of talent that lays, or, you know, the gulf that lays between his talent and the talent of the number two flyweight. And that is my issue with calling him the GOAT at this point.
And I agree with a lot of what you said, but just the difference between him and everyone else is just it's an ocean wide. So it's
inarguable. Yeah. Inarguable.
Right. Yep. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, you're good. I was agreeing with you. He's head and shoulders and feet above the division. Yeah. You know, he stands on a different level. But there's not the level of competition. That division doesn't have the level of fighter that you need to fight in order to be the GOAT. To me, you know, I think I just don't see. And you know, we can extrapolate and say, well, if he was at bantamweight with that level of skill, or if he was a lightweight or light heavyweight, whatever, with that level of skill at any given era, you know, you can pontificate and think of those things. But with other fighters, to me, with your GSPs, with your Anderson Silvas, with your John Jones, you've got evidence in front of you of the skill gap between them and the number two guys. And the number two guys in their cases were former champions or were, you know, legendary fighters themselves. So to put Demetrius Johnson on that same level, you know, based on who they're fighting, I can't do it.
Robert?
I will say fiction as well, and I'm a pretty big Mighty Mouse defender, apologist, if you will. But it's those three guys that Sean just mentioned, with GSP, Jones, and Anderson Silva, which I kind of consider the standard bearers and the Mount Rushmore, if you will, of MMA. And I just don't think he stacks up. And it's not, like you said, it's not really his fault. It's almost a similar argument before her losses you could make to Ronda Rousey, is that you can't really know how good those people that they beat actually were. I will say this. He's probably the most dominant ever as far as of who he's getting matched up against and the skill level differential. That is, I think, the unquestioned thing about it. He's so much more skilled than anybody else ever to be within a division. I think those guys were a lot closer. You know, Matt Hughes and GSP, obviously, that was a great rivalry that went three fights. And, you know, you could see how close all that really was. So I just can't quite, you know, put that crown upon him. You know, there are some interesting things to say. Maybe in this sort of modern era, wherever it started, he's probably clearly the most dominant fighter of that period, because he fought fairly frequently and very dominant fashion with all these other things in the UFC going on. He was very consistent. Maybe that's what you could say. Maybe he's the most consistent fighter that the UFC's ever had.
I'll change the statement. Demetrius Johnson is the most consistent MMA fighter of all time. Sean, fact or fiction?
I'll say fact there. Although I would even throw Fedor in that conversation too, or GSP. But yeah, we'll say DJ could be the most consistent. Sure, I'll give him that.
All right. So this next statement is in light of all the weight cutting issues that we've seen, pretty horrible videos of, and things along those lines. So the statement reads: an MMA fighter will die due to complications from a weight cut. Robert, let's start with you on that one. Is that fact or fiction?
I'm going to say fiction, just because even if it does happen, I think it'll be obfuscated in a way that it's not necessarily blamed on weight cutting. So I'll say fiction, although there definitely needs to be change made in that area.
And I know we touched on this in a previous episode where we all agree, yeah, change needs to be made, but it's really hard to make that change and regulate it and really oversee it. So that's where the biggest issue lies. Sean, what is it, fact or fiction?
Yeah, I'm going to say fact. I think it actually has happened. I have no evidence of that in front of me. I can't remember the exact situation, but I think it's happened with, but the thing is, it was kind of like Robert said, it was obfuscated in a way that made it seem like it was something else, but weight cutting played a part in it. And so, yeah, I think it's inevitable that weight cutting is going to play a part in someone, and someone dying, you know, whether it's only because of weight cutting, I don't know if that's going to happen. That's probably fiction, but weight cutting leading to someone being unfit to fight and going on to fight anyway. Yeah, I think that's happened and it probably will again.
Especially, you know, fights that take place on the regional scene. That's where I really,
yep, you know, yep, see exactly.
Being a real problem. So I guess the statement reads complications from a weight cut. That I think is fact. But like Robert said, can they prove it's, you know, 100% because of the weight cut? I think there's ways around that. So going back to DJ, his fight against Ray Borg, the next statement is DJ's suplex into an armbar submission was the greatest submission of all time. Robert, is that fact or fiction?
I'll say fact just because of what the stakes were and how, like, improbable it seemed. So I'll give it a fact, but, you know, there's probably been greater submissions or more unlikely submissions or, you know, a submission, you know, a comeback submission that somebody has. But just given the stakes and the profile and how sort of out of nowhere it came for such, like, you know, people call him a boring fighter. And then that's going to be like the signature of his career is going to be that highlight.
And lately he's been all but a boring fighter these last couple of fights. So I think he's. Again, you know, he's taking what people are saying and using it against them. Sean, what are your thoughts on that? Is that fact or fiction?
Yeah, I'm going to go fact, too. I put it on Twitter on Saturday night. You know, I've been watching fights for 24 years. I have never seen anything like that. You know, and we've seen a lot of submissions, and that is one of a kind. You know, I mean, it belongs in a pro wrestling ring, so which is something that we may talk about later, but it's insane. I to me, that is the, like Robert said, when you factor in the stakes and you factor in the level at which it happened, I don't think there's been anything more impressive than that.
It was funny too, because I don't know if you guys were listening to the broadcast when Cormier said, the only person I can do that to is John Anik. And it's true. You know what I mean?
I didn't catch that, but that's great.
Like, how do you pull that off against one of the, you know, another top five, top three, you know, flyweights in the world. And you pull something like that off. It's just unfathomable to even try it. You know what I mean? I mean, just the confidence you have to have that. All right. First of all, if I miss this, so what? Nothing's going to happen anyway. And if I hit it, hey, even better. I mean, yeah, it was ridiculous. Okay. So that leads into the next fact or fiction statement. And Sean, I'll start with you on this one. A WWE wrestler will steal the suplex into an armbar submission move.
Fact. And they should. Because it's awesome. Yeah, I think that's definitely fact. I don't know who, but definitely I think you're going to see it.
And Robert's at fact or fiction.
I'm going to say fact, too. I mean, that's what it looked like. It looked like a pro wrestling move when you saw it. And I tweeted out, when it happened, like, oh, God, Nakamura needs to do that immediately. Yes, and I say Nakamura specifically because he has a lot of suplexes in his arsenal. And he does that weird thing where all of a sudden he's just like in a, you know, in an armbar on someone out of nowhere. So I think he would actually be the guy. He might need to do it on a smaller opponent. Maybe AJ Styles at WrestleMania. That's when we see that thing pulled out.
All right, guys, let's wrap up this round of fact or fiction with this last statement here. And I bring this up because I covered both the Bellator card as well as the UFC card for MMATorch.com. And it just got me thinking about it, so I thought I'd bring it up to you guys. Sean, I'll start with you. Fact or fiction, Bellator has a better TV viewing presentation than the UFC.
Ah, jeez. I'm going to say fiction. I think they're pretty, well, this assumes that I've seen a lot of Bellator, and I haven't seen a ton of it. From what I've seen, I like aspects of Bellator presentation, but to me, they're pretty much, there's positives and negatives to both, and they pretty much cancel each other out. They're pretty much on a similar level to me. So I'm gonna say fiction.
And Robert.
I'm actually going to say fact. I've written a few columns about this where I've noted how their television presentation, it just feels like they're more self-aware of what they are and what they're presenting, and that they're being that they're a television product, I feel like they make their presentation more tailor-made to television. It seems like the UFC is still they're always going to be so guarded about the legitimacy of MMA because they're the ones that had to really blaze that trail and legitimize the sport. They've done that groundwork, but so they never want to, you know, look like pro wrestling or any kind of they don't ever want to go too far into that entertainment vein, whereas Bellator is completely aware that that's what they do and what, you know, MMA is. It is sports entertainment, so to speak, even if it's not rigged in that sort of sense. So I think they do a very good job. The only thing that knocks that down, I wrote all those columns about that before Mike Goldberg was the on-air commentator. So that makes it a little more level. But, you know, the previous commentating team, and you have Morrow in there with the entrances and the way they do things. I really do like their television presentation quite a bit.
Yeah, just the fact that you guys are, you know, on opposite ends here really shows that, you know, there is an argument to what Bellator is doing. Now, does it make them, you know, UFC's competitor? No, but it is a real alternative to what the UFC is putting out there. So I just wanted to get your guys' opinion on that. So let's take our final break, and then when we come back, we will review, or I'm sorry, yeah, we'll review UFC or WWE's Hell in a Cell pay-per-view from last night.
When you want to know when the next episode of the PW Torch Livecast is scheduled or catch up on a show you missed, check out our homepage, pwtorchlivecast.com. You can stream the latest shows right from that page, or download the show, or get a link to subscribe on a podcast app. That's pwtorchlivecast.com for the latest shows, and also catch up on shows you missed at pwtorchlivecast.com.
All right, guys, let's talk about Hell in a Cell from last night. I'm going to jump around a little bit here, too, so I'm not going to take these in order, but I do want to start with the opening match where we had the Usos winning the WWE SmackDown Tag Team titles by beating the New Day in 22 minutes. Sean, I'm going to start with you on this one. Were you surprised at how physical this match was? And not only how physical it was, but for an opening match, you know, I think that adds to it.
Yeah, I was a little bit surprised because, like, as you said, it was the opening match. I think as the show went on, it kind of showed why they would do that, because I think the rest of the matches kind of brought the crowd down until the main event. But yeah, I love this match. This is my favorite match on the show. I thought it was great. I think these two teams really, really work well together, especially given how thin the tag team division is. I could see these guys. I could watch those guys work together indefinitely. I mean, to me, it's a great feud. They blend well together in promos. They blend well together in matches. No matter what they've done, it's been good, good to great. This was great, and I thought it was awesome.
Yeah, and what I really liked about it was I like when they present New Day like this with an edge, more serious, as opposed to their take everything as a joke kind of routine. It grows a little old for me as a viewer. So this was definitely a change that I liked.
Yeah, I agree. And I will say this. I actually listened to the roundtable from PW Torch, and Todd Martin mentioned something as well, where WWE really attempts to cartoonify the violence of their of the product, which I think does hurt it. It doesn't do it any favors, you know, with the trombone and the multicolored kendo sticks and things like that. It just makes it adds a little bit of silliness, which I think does bring it down a little bit. But looking past that, I really enjoyed that match a lot.
Yeah, Robert, what were your thoughts on the match?
Yeah, I thought it was just a phenomenal match. This was the first time this match, and then and we'll talk about it later in the main event, since they brought in Hell in a Cell as a pay-per-view gimmick, it's the first time where it felt like all the Hell in a Cell matches really were worthy of the gimmick and were just put there because of, it's October. And the violence in this match, it was almost like the perfect amount of violence, I feel, where I wasn't so worried. There was a few high spots, but I wasn't so worried about the competitors. But what everything they did looked like it really hurt very bad. And then the drama, like the spot where they had Xavier hanging up and they were you know, lashing him with a kendo stick. It was uncomfortable in a good way. And I just thought like they just did a good job. These two teams are very good at being, you know, five of the most athletic guys in the company, but still having a bit of a violent and vicious edge where you definitely felt that one team wants to hurt the other to win the championship. And it's something that gets lost often in modern WWE. And this match was a perfect example of how all that can still work in this sort of, you know, modern PG environment.
Yeah, I thought this was the best.
Yeah, I would say with Big E especially, like he can tend to go full on comedy a lot of times. And when he is like he was last night, he's fantastic. He's fantastic.
Yeah, definitely a singles push somewhere in there with that version of Big E. All right, guys, let's move on here. Let's jump to the Jinder Mahal Shinsuke Nakamura match. We saw Jinder retain the WWE title by pinning Nakamura clean in 12 minutes. Robert, what were your thoughts on this match?
Man, everything about this match was so underwhelming. These guys have no chemistry with each other. We've seen the same Singh brothers finish for like 6 months. The one pay-per-view when, you know, the whole gimmick is you put a, you know, a fence down so other people can't get in. I guess Shinsuke doesn't have the network to figure that whole thing out. It just wasn't very good. It's anything Jinder does just isn't very good. And it was just kind of more of the same. And you just knew it wasn't going to be a title change because of the positioning on the card. This, you know, this was not sold on this match in any way. So, you know, it was a predictable finish that everybody got mad at. So it's kind of one of those things where nobody wins.
And they just don't care either that they don't care that people want to see Nakamura win, which it makes me laugh, but it's infuriating all at the same time. Sean, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I'm completely with you guys on this one. And it was made even more predictable that there was not going to be a title change by the fact that there was already two title changes. So it was even more apparent that it was not going to happen. And really, you know, everything that Jinder does is, to me, is annoying and underwhelming. Like, he comes out and his facial expressions are annoying to me. His matches are not good. His promos are not good. His voice is annoying. Just like, you know, and it's not like heel, like, oh, this guy's good at being a heel. It's just like I'm vastly uninterested in him in everything that he does, just like unimaginably uninterested. So it just wasn't good. And I you got to put some of the blame on Nakamura too. I since he's left NXT, I haven't seen really much out of him. Like he's kind of phoning it in, you know. And even in NXT, you know, he had guys he was working with kind of on a higher level, but even there, I just haven't felt like since he's been stateside, I haven't felt like he has had his heart in everything. Like that, the first match with Sami Zayn was tremendous, and to me, that's been his high point since he's been stateside.
For sure. All right, in the other title match, it was Baron Corbin pinning Ty Dillinger to capture the U.S. title in 19 minutes. I thought this was a good three-way match. I mean, you get your obvious one guy sleeping, you know, out on the ring apron kind of thing, but you're going to get that with these three-way matches. But all in all, I was entertained by the match. I liked the finish only because I now have hopes that this will elevate AJ Styles into a feud with Jinder Mahal. So if that's not the case, I'll hate this decision, and I'll hate the Nakamura decision even more. But if this leads to AJ getting the WWE title, I'm all for it. Sean, start with you on this one. What'd you think?
Yeah, I'm with you on this one. I enjoyed the match. I thought it was good. It was kind of a cop out to add Dillinger to the match late so that he could take the pinfall. But at the same time, if this works to move AJ Styles to the profile position of SmackDown and make him the champion and please move Jinder back down the card to do something else or move him somewhere else, I don't care where that it would be.
Just somewhere else.
move him away. then that would be great. You know, AJ Styles should be the guy that the show is centered around. He should be, and for that reason, he should be the champion. Like the show should be centered around the champion, and that should be AJ Styles. So hopefully that moves him in that direction. I think they'll probably keep him with Corbin for a little bit, maybe do a couple of goofy finishes where he doesn't get the title back, and then move him onto the title picture where he hopefully will save us all from the Jinder Mahal era.
Yeah, and I'm okay with Baron Corbin holding the U.S. title. I think that's a good spot for him. Robert, what do you think?
Yeah, I'm not a big Baron Corbin fan in that, like he's a guy, he's wrestling, and, like, I don't care. With that said, though, he has a kind of heat with me it borders on the Jinder heat, but not quite, where I do kind of, you know, I feel like a little kid again, and I want the good guy always to beat him. So, I think he probably has that just the way he carries himself in his presentation. The match itself, I thought, was a little lackluster in just that Ty Dillinger and Baron Corbin are both these very basic wrestlers that do very basic moves, and there was nothing super exciting. But once they got into that finishing sequence, it was very entertaining. And I'm with you guys that hopefully this sort of like sets AJ free to hover near the main event position. You know, I think it's Bruce Mitchell that always says that, oh, well, you still get, you know, the Kevin Owens and AJ Styles on the SmackDown brand, even if Jinder's the champion. But it's really not. I mean, I think that with the Jinder championship reign, everything has looked so pale because of it. Like, it painted everything to feel so second rate that all these guys are so far below Jinder that AJ, really since that match with Shane, he just kind of has just been spinning his wheels. Even though he got the feud with Kevin Owens for a few months, none of their matches even clicked. So I'm hoping this is a good reset for AJ.
Yeah, and there's just no enthusiasm, you know, just in the overall show. I just don't feel like, I don't want to say like they're not into it, but it just doesn't feel like there's any enthusiasm ever since Jinder had the title.
It's almost like everybody knows you had to feature the champion, and they know that segment is coming. So it's just like it casts a pall over everything.
Yeah. All right, guys, let's move on to the main event. Well, we still have some time here. It was Kevin Owens beating Shane McMahon with the help of Sami Zayn, surprisingly. And this was nothing more than just a big stunt fest. Robert, I'll start with you. What were your thoughts on this match?
Yeah, I really liked this match. I don't think it was probably as good as the tag match because of everything that's going on. And I'm number two behind Todd Martin on the Shane McMahon apologist list here at the Torch. So when I was watching the match, though, I was actually kind of bored with it. Not that it was uninteresting. It just seemed to like go on for a long, like everything just seemed to take a really long time. But once it was over in the full presentation, I thought, okay, that was pretty good. And then my son fell asleep last night watching it. And so I solidified my Father of the Year trophy and watched that main event with him again this morning. And I just thought it was a really good match that told a decent story and didn't look – the only problem I had with it is that, like, there were moments when I watched it on that first viewing where I was legitimately scared for the performance, specifically when they were up top hitting those panels. I thought, oh, God, that's going to break, and this is a much taller cell than 1998. But when it was all said and done, I thought, like, wow, there's a main event for you folks.
Sean, what were your thoughts?
Yeah, I think Robert pretty much hit the high points. I am not much of a Shane McMahon apologist, even though I will say, though, despite that, I enjoyed the match on its face. But I think we have to talk about a couple of things here. Now, the first one being, and this is a minor complaint, but it still annoyed me, the fact that when Kevin Owens raked Shane McMahon's face over the cage towards the beginning of the match, they then panned to Shane's kids who were laughing. It's like, you know, you could probably take a look at them first and make sure that you're going to get the reaction you want before you actually look at them to get their reaction. And it is, boy, what a good time this is. And then my main issue with this match was Shane McMahon's punches are the worst thing I have ever seen in my life. And, Wade Keller harps on this all the time, but this was really apparent to me in this match because he went so heavy on the punches early in the match. And then when they got outside the cell, they were just terrible. Like, Shane McMahon is the epitome of could not bust a grape in a fruit fight with these punches. They were awful, 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 just terrible stuff. And that was the worst part of the match to me. But otherwise, I actually did enjoy what they did there. I thought, like, kind of like Todd said, you know, I thought they were relatively safe with the insane looking bumps. Although I, like you guys, was also pretty concerned when they were at the top of the cage, you know, having seen what happened with The Undertaker and Mick Foley and knowing that that wasn't planned for the panel to come falling down. Yeah. That did make me nervous. But other than that, you know, I wasn't too awful concerned. Although, I mean, the psychology was not great for Shane going to the top of the top of the cage. I'm interested to see what they do with Sami Zayn now, and hopefully this leads to more of a showcase for him, that he'll be kind of more visible and presented better on the show. But my main complaint being the laughter on seeing their dad raped across the coals there, and then just the punches that were just awful.
Yeah, I think going forward, if they're going to keep having Shane do these, and I don't know how much longer they can have him keep doing these types of matches, they have to make these matches shorter, because he was gassed.
Oh, man, immediately.
And that was my biggest complaint, was watching just how tired he was. So, yeah, if they can just shorten those, I think it would help a lot. And as far as Sami Zayn goes, I think the only way this really makes sense for them to do this is if now Kevin Owens returns the favor and helps Zayn when he's in trouble. Because right now it just seems like kind of out of left field, and we really don't know where it's going yet. So I think to really make it seem like, yeah, they're best friends again or whatever it is, I think we need to see Kevin Owens come to the aid of Sami Zayn to really put this pairing on the right foot going forward. So let's touch on the last two matches quickly here. In the WWE Women's title match, Charlotte got the win via DQ, so Natty retained the title. This match went 13 minutes, and it was a match I did not like whatsoever. I mean, I get the psychology of it, working the leg and all that, but it was too much of it, and it just got to be monotonous and boring for me. Robert, we'll start with you on this one. What were your thoughts on this match?
I didn't think the match itself was that bad. Just the finish just kind of came out of nowhere. And if they're going to do more, I don't have a problem with it. It would just, that was the whole problem with after that initial cell match, just the rest of these matches, it just felt hard. Felt difficult to care about anything else that was going on because the way it was sandwiched with those cell matches. And I think this match is one that definitely suffered from that. But they have good chemistry in general, so I'm kind of hoping that they reset this thing and give them a proper, 15-20-minute match on the next pay-per-view.
Yeah, this show is definitely bookend by the two best matches, and then you can really miss a lot of the middle stuff. Sean, what did you think?
Yeah, it was fine. It was pretty forgettable. I didn't hate it. Didn't have a whole lot of feeling about it, honestly. The decent psychology. I understood what the story that they told, and that was fine. Good opening chapter, I would say, to a hopefully more extended rivalry.
And finally, we had Robert Roode beating Dolph Ziggler with a pull of the tights in 12 minutes. And then Randy Orton pinned Rusev clean after an RKO out of nowhere in 17 minutes. We'll kind of take these two together. Sean, start with you. Anything stick out in either of these two matches?
Rusev, they could do so much more with him than putting him with Randy Orton. And Bobby Roode, I don't know, man. I don't know if anyone is being done any favors by wrestling Dolph Ziggler anymore. I mean, based on this terrible... What's that?
I said, no, nobody's been done any favors.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think this match did anything for anyone, for either of those guys. And, you know, it's not going to help Bobby Roode get over as a babyface. And, you know, as far as Orton Rusev, I mean... Just turn Orton heel so that he's interested in doing something, man. I mean, I'm not really interested in watching any Randy Orton matches. You know, they all pretty much look the same and they end the same with an RKO out of nowhere. And You know, I think Rusev is just capable of a lot more, and they're not giving it to him right now.
Yeah, and it's the same argument that the guys at PW Torch keep talking about, is just how everybody's so miscast. Turn Root heel, turn Orton heel, and make Rusev one of your top baby faces. I mean, to me, it's a no-brainer. Robert, what did you think? Actually, of the two matches.
Yeah, Ziggler-Rude, I think, like, technically was a fine match. Like, in a vacuum, it just, like, it felt like nobody cared. It just felt like there was no reason to care. And then Orton and Rusev, I'm going to throw a hot take out there, but when I was watching it, I was just thinking to myself, wow, Randy Orton is a terrible professional wrestler. And what I mean by that is technically everything he does is very good. It's better than most guys on the roster. Like, think about him next to John Cena. He is better at every, you know, wrestling move than John Cena is. Yeah, a guy like Cena can get you invested in a match, and Randy Orton is terrible at getting me invested in anything he's doing. It's just, it looks like exercise out there. And, you know, if he's not going to care, or if he's going to emote that he doesn't care, why should I care about what he's doing?
Yeah, if there's anyone that just goes through the motions, it's Randy Orton. All right, guys, any final thoughts before we wrap up? All right, that'll do it for this episode of MMA Talk for Pro Wrestling Fans. Robert, go ahead and give our listeners info on how they can follow you and anything else that you want to plug.
Sure. Follow me on Twitter at Rob M. Vallejos, RobMVallejos. Hopefully I'll have that article that I teased last week going up on PW Torch this week. Getting rain here in the desert is like a national disaster, so hopefully I'll be back on track this week.
And Sean, go ahead and let our listeners know how they can follow you.
You got me on Twitter. It's Sean Ennis, S-H-A-W-N-E-N-N-I-S. You can hear about all things pro wrestling, MMA, and Philadelphia sports. Go Eagles.
And you can follow me on Twitter at FightChampBlog. And you can read all my columns, as always, at MMATorch.com. And if I can just get 1 point from the Minnesota defense tonight, I will be a happy man. All right. Appreciate it, guys. For Sean and Robert, my name is Mike Grocki, and we will be back next week for another episode of MMA Talk for Pro Wrestling Fans.
PW Torch Livecast listeners, I invite you to get even more of what the Torch offers by becoming a PW Torch VIP member. Not only do you get ad-free access to our website, the mobile site, and the desktop site, and access to about 30 years of our archives, including over 1,500 back issues and thousands upon thousands of hours of our audio shows going back to 2004, plus tons of retro radio shows from the 1990s. But you also get over 15 VIP exclusive podcasts per week, in addition to ad-free editions of these PW Torch livecasts throughout the week. So we take the ads out of the PW Torch livecast for VIP members and then give you over 15 other podcasts per week, including what started it all, the Bruce Mitchell Audio Show. I host that with Bruce every weekend, and we spend a couple hours talking about the biggest stories of professional wrestling and wrestling history. It's one of the longest-running weekly pro wrestling podcasts on any subject, and it's one of the main reasons people go VIP and stay VIP. Another is The Fix with Todd Martin. I host that every midweek with Todd, and we get Todd's expertise and opinions every midweek on current events in professional wrestling, not just WWE, but all promotions worldwide, including New Japan. Plus, we end every show with some expert MMA talk from the LA Times columnist and SureDog contributor, Todd Martin. And there's so much more. The Every Single Day Weight Cutter Hotline with news updates every single day, Monday through Friday. And every Saturday and Sunday, I do the Ask the Editor format of the Weight Cutter Hotline, where I answer VIP member questions in depth. And there's so much more. There's the Wayback Playback with Pat McNeil and Jim Valley, Wrestling Audio Community with Sean Radican, the WWE Future Pass Show with scouting reports on prospects and a look back at the indie career of current stars, the PW Torch East Coast Cast Extended VIP Edition, the retro radio shows. Every Thursday, a new retro radio show from the 90s drops, from the early 90s or the Attitude Era. And last but not least, my in-depth Raw and SmackDown reports. You can get a full chronological rundown of every episode of Raw and SmackDown with my analysis of the show in-depth every Monday night and Tuesday night. So check out details at pwtorch.com/govip. We give you a lot here at the livecast, but there is so much more. The vast majority of our work is for our VIP members, and you can become one today. Go check out details on a subscription at pwtorch.com/govip.
Yeah.